from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, when author Gary Steingart was 7 years old, he emigrated with his parents from St. Petersburg, Russia to Queens, New York. As a small boy with severe asthma, he recalls sitting alone in the school cafeteria talking to himself in Russian and wearing a giant fur hat. Even his own mother used to call him Little Failure. The author of Absurdistan and Super Sad True Love Story joins us to talk about his new memoir, Little Failure, which the New York Times has called hilarious and moving. And that's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. When author Gary Steingart was, when he was last with us on Forum, he had just published his best-selling book, Super Sad True Love Story, and he was a novelist then, an author of other novels, including Absurdistan, chosen as one of the year's 10 best books by the New York Times Book Review and Time Magazine, and the Russian Debutante's Handbook, which won the Stephen Crane Award for First Fiction. Now he's moved from fiction into memoir and published a book called Little Failure, which, contrary to the trailer on the book that makes it seem as if his publisher was responsible for the title, was a name given to him by his mother when his name actually then was Igor. Yes, like Frankenstein's assistant. Little Failure is a family story, and it's a story about immigration and a family of parents of an asthmatic only child whose personal family histories are filled with grim tragedies and who came to America as refugees from the Soviet Union in a deal during the Carter administration of grain in exchange for Jews. Gary Steingart's work, known both for its humor and its tenderness, has appeared in The New Yorker, Esquire, GQ, Travel and Leisure, and The New York Times Magazine. Joins us in studio for the second hour, and so glad to have you back with us.
Great to be back. Thanks.
Well, I had said there's a lot of dots that connect here. Chang Ray Lee was with us earlier. He was a teacher and mentor of Gary's and an editor, really, when he was at Columbia. And it turns out James Franco was a student of Gary's. So there's all kinds of dovetailing here. And I mention that because a trailer was put out.
Yes.
I want to actually talk about this initially because I really want to talk about your book. But trailers for book promotion, how do they do?
Well, people don't really like to read books anymore. So at first, before you sell a book, I mean, outside of San Francisco and Brooklyn, people don't like to read books. So before we send the book out, we have to make a movie about it. So I gathered up some of my friends, James Franco, Rashida Jones, Jonathan Franzen, and we all sort of threw them
in. Small name friends
that I just happened to run into on the streets of Manhattan. And we made a trailer.
Well, I want to hear a cut from this. First, we're going to hear you talking with your two book publishers before going home and talking with your husband, who is played by James Franco.
So, Gary, what are we going to call your new memoir?
Well, I wanted a title that celebrates my quiet brilliance. I was thinking Portrait of the Artist as a Young Mensch, or a heartbreaking work of staggering Jewness. Maybe one of those two.
We've done a focus group, and readers associate you with two words. Little.
Because of your small stature.
And failure.
Because you're a failure.
Can I discuss this with my husband? Little Failure? After the hundreds of books I've sold for Random House, after I've been translated into one language.
Canadian isn't a language, baby.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Look, I don't think of you as a failure. And I certainly don't think of you as little.
You're sweet.
And I have a surprise for you.
Uh-huh.
I wrote my own book.
Uh-huh.
It's coming out next week. Look.
I have a memoir coming out in January, and you, James Franco, are going to be stealing my thunder a little bit.
Don't think of this as a memoir. Think of this as an homage.
Homage?
Yeah. I want the world to celebrate our erotic journey.
The last voice you heard was James Franco playing Gary Steingart's husband in this book trailer, and they're both dressed in pink bathrobes, and that trailer is on our website, kqed.org. And there's already been some blowback. J. Byron Loudon of Slate says homophobic cliches, too much effeminacy, pink bathrobes, all that sort of thing. He was pretty harsh, in fact. He said he knew it wasn't malicious, but it was offensive.
Please. If making out with James Franco makes me intolerant, I want to be intolerant. There were about 67 takes of that kiss. There was a very long kiss.
Told you shouldn't kiss your students?
Oh, my God. Well, at Columbia, we're allowed to once they graduate. There's a lot of kissing that goes on. So James Franco, my God, I mean— Very, very soft lips.
So does he have a book out called 50 Shades of Gary?
He does have a book out called 50 Shades of Gary, which is a celebration of our erotic journey together.
Well, as you can tell, there's a lot of humor that is associated with Gary Steingart. And this trailer, if nothing more than promoting the book, also gives light to that. But it's also, I think, with your work, a lot of the fiction can be seen in light of this memoir. I mean, the fiction, in many respects, was drawn from your life, and here you have a memoir which, and it reminds me of a book that Philip Roth, I know you've been compared to Philip Roth enough probably to make you sick, and Woody Allen and so forth.
I'll take it. No problem.
Yeah, okay.
Keep comparing me, yeah.
Well, Roth wrote a book called The Facts, where he was trying to get away from the novel and just present things as they were, as opposed to what his imagination did. And it was pretty dry, whereas this book is animated, it's alive, it's funny, but it's also a book that catalogs, you know, it's an immigrant book, it's a book about your family, and most of your family in terms of your mother's side, your father's side, going through Stalinist purges, going through wars, tragedies.
Yeah. Well, this book is sort of an attempt to understand who my parents are and why we've had the kinds of relationships we've had, both good and bad. You know, they were incredibly creative, loving parents. My father would tell me stories, little science fiction stories when I was a kid that helped me become the writer I am today.
The planet of the Yids.
The planet of the Yids.
Being bombed by pork.
Yes, it was a planet filled with Jews that was constantly being attacked by pork torpedoes. So, you know, when you have a father who teaches you things like that, you are bound to become a satirist one way or another. But there were difficulties in the relationship as well. They wanted me very much to be an extension of themselves, a lawyer, you know, as opposed to a writer, and which is where the term little failure came about. After I graduated from college, I was living in a 100-square-foot roach-infested apartment with a floor that sloped so much I would wake up on one part of it. I'd go to sleep on one part of it and wake up in another. And my mother came up and saw it and said, oh, failure, chica, little failure. You know, so there was a lot of good and bad, but the book, I think, attempts to really create a kind of 20th century story because I grew up in one failing superpower, the Soviet Union, and then I moved to another failing superpower. So it's, you know, I wanted to capture both the humor and the horror of that journey.
Well, you do. And your father, as you say, you know, comes off as a good storyteller, as a man of humor, but also as a melancholy man. I mean, he wanted to be an opera singer. He failed to reach his dream. He may have even had some envy because you became an artist.
Yeah.
He had this really, in many ways, terrible life, which you, again, narrate here. His mother, your grandmother, remarried a man who probably had more influence on you indirectly than anybody in your life.
Yeah, his father was killed when he was very young during World War II. He was a soldier. They were trying to – the Germans had surrounded Leningrad, my grandfather was killed during one of the battles. My father was taken out of Leningrad, and his first memories – there's a sort of catalog of his very first memories in this book. First memories include somebody coming to their house to tell them that his father was killed. Second memory is being evacuated from Leningrad, jumping under a train as the German Luftwaffe strafed the train. The third is the death of his best friend from starvation or some disease, also like 3 or 5 years old. And then his cousin jumping out of a window as a pack of rats pursued them. Even the rats had to eat, so they were trying to eat the children. So anyway, with happy memories like that. And his stepfather was a very cruel man. Even his best friends called him Goebbels. That was his nickname. So
Goebbels, the Nazi.
Yes, yes.
This is a book not only about your personal history in terms of your family and the emigration from the Soviet Union, suffering kid with asthma and finally finding an inhaler in Vienna, sort of like, you know, finding the Sacred Grail or something like that.
Yeah.
But I was also struck by what you describe as a kind of a portrait of the artist, you know, like you joke about portrait of the artist as a young man, but portrait of the artist developing an imagination, how your imagination developed, how you became a storyteller.
You know, it's first thing you got to do is you got to have asthma as a kid. You know, it worked for Proust. It'll work for anyone. If you can't move a lot and you're just stuck in your bed, I guess now kids will play with their iPad. But in those iPad-free days, there were books and books only. And so you read and you wrote and you read and you wrote. And my grandmother, who was a journalist for Evening Leningrad, a lovely paper, much better than Morning Leningrad, I should say, she asked me to write a novel for her when I was about 5 years old, you know, in Russia.
And she bribed you, didn't she?
She paid me, one piece of cheese for each page I wrote. So I wrote a 100-page novel. I love that cheese. And even today, Random House pays me.
Remember what
cheese.
Kind of cheese it was?
It was this sort of yellow, plasticky Soviet cheese. I mean, you could probably, boink someone over the head and knock them out with it. But I wrote a novel called Lenin and His Magical Goose, which was about Lenin meeting a magical goose, invading Finland and creating a socialist revolution up there. And Grandma loved it. She was a communist, and she thought invading Finland with a goose was a good thing to do.
Well, you grew up with this, not necessarily love of communism, but certainly love of Mother Russia, and you came to the United States, and this was the enemy.
Well, it was love of communism. The Red Army, there was a huge statue of Lenin outside our window, and each morning when I wasn't dying of asthma, I'd give a pedestal a big hug. I mean, I really loved that stuff. And then we were in Rome, which was one of those stops between Russia and America, and my father sat me down and said, it's all a lie, communism, the Red Army, Lenin, it was all a lie. And, you're 7 years old and somebody tells you that, somebody says, hey, okay, now you got to stop believing in Lenin and start believing in Ronald Reagan. And that's quite a sea change right there.
Yeah, your dad was pretty conservative in his political views, even to the point where he got you out there working for Bush Sr.
That's right, yes. I was, it's so difficult to talk about this, especially in San Francisco. But yes, I volunteered for the George H.W. Bush campaign.
And your dad was drawn to Kahana and the Koch Party?
The Koch Party, yes, trying to eliminate the Arabs in Israel. Yeah.
Well, that's how do you deal with that lineage, so to speak? I mean,
you end up at Oberlin.
And that changes. Yeah, your experiences at Oberlin. As I said, a lot of, craziness about girls, of course, as many do in those early years of college, falling in love and all, but also a lot of getting wasted.
Yes, I think there was a lot of sort of unprocessed Igor Gary out there. Yeah, my first name was Igor, and then we switched it to Gary. We rearranged the letters and came out as Gory, and then we made the O into an
Your
A.
Your whole name is foul.
Everything is false.
Steingart is not
Steingart
a real name.
Isn't, the real name was Steinhorn, which means, I think, stone horn. So my real name is Igor Stonehorn, which makes me into, a Bavarian porn star of sorts, but yeah, at Oberlin, my moniker was Scary Gary because as wasted as that campus is, I somehow took it a step further.
And when you were younger, your moniker was Red Gerbil.
I had a lot of, Red Gerbil, Little Failure, Snotty.
But the Red Gerbil is important because here you come to, your parents put you in a Hebrew school and a little bit like Siberia maybe. I mean, very difficult. That's probably an invidious analogy. Siberia is horrible, pretty horrible.
Hebrew school is not as bad as Siberia.
But you went through some really tough times there, and it was perhaps even traumatizing, wouldn't be too hard a word to use. And yet the fact of the matter is that there you were feeling like the second most hated kid in the school and trying to adjust to American life. Difficult.
We just came at the wrong time for this. I mean, Ronald Reagan had made his evil empire speech, and commies, as we were called, we were really looked down upon. My parents thought that if they sent me to a Hebrew school, I would be surrounded by my own people and beloved, of course, by the people that saved us and brought us over from here. But the fact of the matter is that I started to pretend to the kids that I was born in East Berlin. So here I was in a Hebrew school trying to convince Jewish kids I was a German, which was better than being a Russian. It was kind of a disaster.
If you had, I know, since you have the novelist's imagination, if you had stayed in Russia, what do you suppose would have come of you?
Either an oligarch, living in Switzerland half the year and London the other half, or dead, The two are not usually mutually exclusive, even the
She would not have, as Francine Pro said, become the novelist from this experience that you had in America.
Yes. No, I think my life really, because of this one superpower to another, my life was formed in a way that would be very advantageous for a writer because there's so much to write about. And even from an early age, Saul Bellow talks about how to become a writer, and he says the writer is the great noticer, just constantly takes notes on everything. And that's what I was. I was always very cognizant of the fact that somehow everything around me felt very special.
Even you when you were wasted? Because we're going to do an hour next week with this woman who's written a book about drinking and writing,
right. So when I was wasted at Oberlin, I don't remember anything, and all the memories exist from very blurry photographs, some of which are in the memoir, and also from my first girlfriend, who was a wonderful letter writer, and she wrote 15, 20-page letters. Before email, people wrote 15, 20-page letters to each other, which we would send across campus. Ridiculous, and I would write back, and so reading those letters really reconstituted that period for me, because otherwise, who can remember any of it?
Well, but this is a book about memory, too, isn't it? Really?
It is.
You mentioned Proust before, and Proust is even mentioned in the book. And in a sense, you're trying to revivify and bring back memory. You're also doing a lot of maybe what might be useful in the way of psychoanalysis, and you've been through a number of years of that.
Well, I'm not one of those crazy New York writers who spends 5 days a week in psychoanalysis. I only do four days a week, so I'm
Has it helped?
Yeah, it's only been 12 years, but we're finally getting somewhere.
Well, you got Woody Allen as a model there. Is he still doing it?
I don't think he is.
No?
He went over 20 years, though.
I know, but
I think it's over because finally the space freed up on the couch for me, so...
So, but your libidinous life, such as it is, kind of had its seminal moments with Emmanuel.
Yes. One of the first movies, you know, we came to America, there were these beautiful movie theaters on Main Street in Flushing, and we heard of a movie called Emmanuel, which I think was called The Joys of a Woman. And it was a French film, and my father and I were very excited. You know, French culture can't be beat. So we went into the movie, and for those of you who grew up during that time, it was a very X-rated movie. And so we spent the entire movie with my father's hand clasped to my eyes and me trying to remove it to catch a glimpse of any genital I could, you know. And I think I saw 7 more genitals than I would see for the rest of my life.
There are moments in this memoir of yours that really, have to do with what you just described, that eye of yours or those the observational powers you have. And I don't know if you saw the movie Nebraska, but dovetailing with kind of the theme of that. I mean, your parents actually believed the publisher clearinghouse thing.
We all did. I mean, I thought we were going to be multimillionaires. I thought I would go to Hebrew school instead of being the second most hated boy in school in his giant fur hat and some made out of some woodland animal from Russia. I'd be, you know, this multimillionaire and that I would buy everyone a Carvel cookie cream ice cream that that cost 60 cents and was 60 cents more than we had. So I thought our lives were going to change, and they didn't, you know. And it was one of the first moments where we thought, wow, capitalism can lie to us too. In Russia, you know, everything was a lie. But when you said, you know, you get an envelope that says you have already won $10 million, you just have to subscribe to these 5 magazines. And then there was no $10 million. I mean, I think that was the first time that I began to think that America was not the absolute model of perfection that we thought it was.
Still feel like a failure deep down?
Well, a little bit of failure sticks to you. You know, it's it continues on a little bit, but it's compartmentalized. Yeah.
You've been so, your parents must be very proud. I mean,
they
the literary
proud,
fame
yes,
that you have.
Yes,
and
well, you know, it's literary fame as opposed to real fame. So,
well, there is a distinction.
There is
that's
a distinction.
True. Yeah. But I remember you were writing early on about the Russian internet saying some sour things about your novels, but then you got really good press in France and that.
Well, yeah, my father, you know, my father likes to make these jokes, as he calls them. So one joke was during my mother's birthday a few years ago, he said, "I read on the Russian internet that you and your novels will soon be forgotten." Funny stuff, you know.
But then France saved you, as it were. Again,
and then the next week he called and said, "Oh, this French magazine says you're the best." So up and down, that's the Russian, you know, how to raise a kid the Russian way.
Well, there is a lot of that in this book and a lot of kind of the suffering and tragedy we associate with Russian. It's given birth to great writers, Dostoevsky and Turgenev, and the list goes on and on. But I thought your family tragedy was particularly fascinating because there was a lot of, for lack of a better way to describe it, class conflict between your mother and your father.
Yeah. I mean, I think in some ways part of their conflict is that he grew up in a little village. He was herding cows and there was a shepherd running around. And it was, you know, the Soviet Union was rapidly industrializing and urbanizing. But my father grew up in a very different environment. My mother was the daughter of there was no well-to-do in the Soviet Union, but fairly, you know, fairly meaningful economist, and her mother was, as I mentioned, a journalist. So they were very different class very different classes, even though the Soviet Union was supposed to be a classless society. And I think that had a huge impact on their marriage and on the fact that they were just very different people.
Well, there's one moment in the memoir where your mother shows a photograph and talks about how happy she was then, as opposed to one gleans where
right.
she is now.
Yes, she has many photos of herself in a, you know, smiling in the wearing a red pioneer scarf, you know. But on the other hand, she also has photo albums that are titled, you know, Uncle Semyon's Family Buried Alive 1943. So history continues to haunt them in a way that, you know, people growing up in, I don't know, Cape Cod maybe don't have those kinds of albums with relatives buried alive. Maybe they do. I don't know.
It was also absurd of me to make that analogy to Siberia because you actually had an uncle who was in a Siberian labor camp. For poetry, essentially, wasn't it?
Yes, he wrote some poetry that the head of his platoon, he joined, he was, his whole family was killed before his eyes during the Holocaust. The Germans shot them. But he managed to escape and join the partisans. And with the Red Army, he made it all the way to Berlin, you know, when they liberated Germany. But then he said something about admiring a German tank, the technology of a German tank. And then he wrote a poem that the head of his platoon thought he was hitting on his girlfriend through that poem or something of that sort. And he ended up, you know, 10 years in the... So from seeing your family killed in front of your eyes by Hitler to being sent to 10 years of labor camp by Stalin, I think that sort of sums up what that generation went through.
Now, these family stories shaped your imagination to a great extent. In fact, what's the story about But for a Cigar, your father would have been an American?
Yes. So my grandmother was being courted by a rich American who had stopped by and he really loved her. And her father was the rabbi of the local village. They were about to get married, but then he was very Americanized. He probably had a Studebaker back in Chicago or something. And he whipped out a cigar on the Sabbath, the holy day, and started smoking it. And the rabbi said, "This marriage will never happen." Had he not had that cigar, I could have been born in Burbank or, you know, Sausalito, I don't know, something.
It's... also, I think important to just touch on, and we're talking about Gary Steingart, and his new book is called Little Failure. He's the author of three novels, including Super Sad True Love Story, and he'll be at the Jewish Community Center tonight at 7 o'clock p.m. That you really get into in your early development how, you know, you were certainly made to feel as an outsider because you were from Russia and being Jewish to a degree too. But there was all this fear and all this animus toward blacks and Hispanics, which kind of put you in at least a kind of different tier.
Yeah. I mean, I think people always need to look down upon someone. And here we were a bunch of immigrants clad in the wrong furs.
Greenhorns, they used to call them.
We were fresh off the boat. And who are you going to look down upon? And you turn on the news and Ronald Reagan's talking about all these black welfare queens that are stealing all our money. And, you know, so that's who you look down upon. And it's shameful and awful, but that's how we grew up. You know.
And how do you break those kind of mind-forged manacles, to use Blake's term?
Right. Well, the only way to do it is, you know, you leave the very protected environment in which you grow up. I mean, I grew up in Queens. I thought that these three tiny skyscrapers on Queens Boulevard, that was Manhattan. You know, for the longest time, I thought that that's what it was. And when I got to Manhattan, to Stuyvesant High School, I just realized that, my God, there's one of the smartest kids in school is of Palestinian descent, and the most beautiful girl in school is clearly of Puerto Rican descent. And it's just all these stereotypes were just shattered, you know, in a matter of months.
So it was girls again that changed.
Well, of course. I mean, what else? You know, how else are you going to?
Do you find now, I know literary fame may not be real fame, but some of these people, you know, who you knew in elementary school who made you feel like the outsider and everything are coming back saying, "Gary."
I'm not sure that many of them read books, but no. I think a couple of them do, but God bless them, yeah.
Well, you are welcome to join us with our guest this hour, Gary Steingart. Again, his new book is called Little Failure, a Memoir. And if you'd like to join the program, you can do it by phone. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, any questions or comments, or any readers of Steingart's. 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, Gary Steingart, our guest this hour. He was 7 when he emigrated with his parents from St. Petersburg, Russia, to Queens, New York. And as a small boy with severe asthma, he recalls sitting alone in the school cafeteria, talking to himself in Russian and wearing a giant fur hat. Even his own mother used to call him Little Failure. The author of Absurdistan and Super Sad True Love Story, here with us talking about his new memoir, which the New York Times called hilarious and moving. And you can join us on the program if you have something you'd like to add to the conversation, or if you'd like to simply join us with questions or comments. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Go to your calls. Nima is our first caller. Good morning.
Hi. How you doing, Michael? I wanted to make a comment about, I came from Iran, and when I was 13, my brother was 7. So it's really familiar. And when we came, everyone was going to L.A., but we ended up coming to Bay Area, the tech world, and, you know, I wasn't very techy. So I also read a lot of books on my own time in the cafeteria. One book that I did read was called Kaffir Boy. That kind of changed my perception of what it
was. Well, that was about South Africa. I remember that book, yeah.
Yeah. And that, it was an amazing book, and it always instilled me the idea of journalism and being a writer. What is a book for you? I was wondering, there has to be one book for you that changed your perception about journalism or journalism about life. I was wondering if you have that.
Right. Thank you for your question. Actually, it was interesting because the choices we had when we came to this country was New York or San Francisco. And my mother very much wanted to go to San Francisco, which she thought was a more beautiful European sort of town.
Were they pushing for Israel too?
No, we never really considered Israel. Israel was pushing for us to go to Israel,
but we never
did. But, you know, had I ended up in San Francisco, I probably would have been much wealthier and working in tech as opposed to writing.
You would have been an oligarch.
I would have been a different guy. I would have been a Bryn-like oligarch probably. But what happened, I think the book that really influenced me growing up was Tom Sawyer, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, which I read in Russian. It was a Russian edition with a introduction by some Soviet party hack, you know, denouncing America and saying that Twain was probably a communist, etc. But I read it and I just, hearing that slang, even though it was translated into Russian, reading about that Mississippi, I fell in love with the Mississippi so much, and also with Becky Thatcher, the judge's daughter, and she was really beautifully illustrated in the Soviet edition. And I thought, wow, any book I write will be a kind of picaresque, will involve, you know, adventures, kids, you know, people getting into all kinds of adventures. So Tom Sawyer, and then in Russian you pronounce it Gekelberry Finn, was the other great book that I read by Twain.
And your family didn't come to San Francisco because?
We had a lot of relatives in New York. They worked at a flea market, and we thought that would probably be a better shot.
And we'll go to another call here, and that's Neil. Good morning.
Yeah. Did any movies influence you at all? Do you recall seeing any movies in English about Russia that you liked?
Well, I'll tell you the movie that really influenced me, being, you know, I'm a Soviet Ashkenazi pessimist, a sap in the industry. So I like movies where things really come to a bad end. The movie that I grew up with, and I think many of my generation grew up with, was The Day After, in which Kansas City, Missouri gets blown to bits. In fact, I always wanted to visit Kansas City just because I feel like I know it like the back of my hand, because I was so impressed by that movie. We expected the end to come shortly. And I remember Ronald Reagan making that famous "We Begin Bombing in 5 minutes" speech. And being the young Republican that I was, I remember laughing along with it and then thinking, but wait a minute, my grandmother is still in Leningrad. So does that mean she gets bombed as well? How does that work?
You've been back to Russia. In fact, you write about it in the book, going back to Russia.
Yeah.
And can't go home again, obviously.
You can't, but it's important to reconnect, I think, with the place that you're from. You know, this is the immigrant novel has sort of given way to the global novel because, you know, back in the day, Henry Ross called it sleep. You made the journey from Norway or Galicia or whatever. And
I think that's the best immigrant novel that's ever been written that I've ever read.
I completely agree. I teach that at Columbia. But yes, you sailed forth and you never came back, whereas now, you know, Moscow is a 9-hour flight away from New York. So it's very different. I think that the very tenor of it has changed. But yeah, I go back every year because I feel like I need to suffer some more, and I need to feel the depression that permeates, you know, the canals and buildings of St. Petersburg. And that helps me understand my own parents more, and obviously myself as well.
And what kind of response have you had from Russian readers, other than the one you just referenced before that your father picked up on and joked about?
Good ones. One review of Absurdistan was a balding traitor betrays motherland. That's pretty good, you know.
By
Russian
balding
standards. Well, kind of, you know, somewhat balding. Steingart pleases his American masters was another good one. So I'm beloved by the 80 people that have read me in Russian translation. Yeah.
More than the Simon Schechter school in terms of number of readers, huh?
Yes.
You went, and you write about this, you went through a circumcision at the
age. I hope you weren't going to bring that up, but you have.
Well,
I'm kidding.
it was somewhat traumatic at the age that you were, age 8?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think about Frankie Alpine in Melman's novel, The Assistant.
Right.
You know, he's an adult, but boy, It was quite an experience, wasn't it?
It didn't heal so well. You know, it was very painful. Don't try this at home. You know, don't circumcise your kids unless they're really, really small. And
home births, but not home circumcisions.
Home births, but don't bring your own knife into the fight, so to speak.
And how's your asthma?
Much better. Much better.
You're not getting any cupping anymore, though.
Yes. In Russia, we had a method, I think it's used in China as well, called cupping, where if you had mucus in your lungs, your parents took a glass bottle, put a flame inside it, which scares the hell out of a small kid, and then that takes away the air, and then there's suction against your skin. So when we landed in Vienna, the first normal country we went to, it was Austria, the doctor saw the giant bruises along my back and was about to call their version of social services. He thought my parents were beating the stuffing out of me, and then my parents said, no, it's cupping. And he said, oh, you crazy Russians. And he gave us an inhaler, an asthma inhaler, and the asthma just went away. You know, it was that simple.
That was quite a moment for you to discover the inhaler.
Discover that breathing was possible.
That breathing, yeah, it must have been like better than women?
Breathing is better than women. Yeah, well, one requires the other, I think.
Exactly.
Or vice versa.
Here's a tweet. I've been looking forward to Laughing and Crying with Gary Steingart today. No one tells our story better. That's our story, by the
That's
way.
Nice.
Gerald writes, Mr. Steingart should, if he has not yet, read Umberto Eco on Fascism. As I am reminded of Eco's in 1942, at the age of 10, I received the first provincial award of Ludi Juveniles. This is a quote from Eco. Mm-hmm. A voluntary compulsory competition for young Italian fascists, that is, for every young Italian. I elaborated with rhetorical skill on the subject, should we die for the glory of Mussolini and the immortal destiny of Italy? My answer was positive. I was a smart boy.
That's right. Always say yes. When you're a kid, always say yes to whatever ideology is offered, because otherwise you're going to get hit a lot.
Well, did you feel when you came into the enemy territory, that is American capitalism and all, that you were being sort of spoon-fed or maybe even force-fed a different ideology?
You know, we landed, we walked out of the airport, which itself looked like a spaceship. We saw a Chevrolet Corvette that looked more like an airplane than a car. We ate honeycomb cereal that beat out Kasha by, 10 kilometers. How do you not fall in love with America after you come from the Soviet Union? I mean, it was like landing in the sea of technicolor. It was amazing.
And yet it was, you talk about all the wealth and the resources of America, and yet it was tough to get a 69-cent McDonald's burger?
It wasn't tough. My parents just, they, like many immigrants, they always thought that the worst would happen. So they saved every penny they could, What if they lose their jobs? What if their English isn't good enough? What if we become as homeless as those welfare queens that, Ronald Reagan keeps talking about? By the way, the earlier comment, it was very sweet of that person to say we, because there is really, I find that actually in the Bay Area, there's much more of a kind of Russian community than almost anywhere else. And there's a group that they call themselves the 79ers. And I've had lunch with them a couple of times. They're people who emigrated in 1979. That was the big year when we left. And of course, all of them work in tech and stuff. But it's really great to see that kind of bonding in this, in a community that's usually spread out all across the United States.
My brother was married to a Russian woman, Russian Orthodox, Russian family, and they used to go to the Russian River all the time. Yeah. And, so I was exposed to a lot of the culture and a lot of the people. They said, many of these Russian immigrants, in fact, that the Peruskis and the Pimyenis in San Francisco are better than Russia.
Well.
Just not saying a lot, I guess.
Well, maybe the ingredients are better, maybe the different cut of desiccated cow is better here. I don't know.
Here's a tweet from Anthony. It says, Gary, loving your interview. When describing how your father grew up, I started singing, Is Given a Mola Pashtekel. You know that?
I don't know. I don't know that song. I know just abyssal Yiddish from my grandma, but sadly, I don't know that song.
You had to learn Hebrew, though, too.
Oh, right? Did I have to learn Hebrew?
Oh, yeah. Oy is a Yiddish word.
Yeah, I know. What would be the Hebrew equivalent? Oh.
Something like that, yeah. you had to learn two languages at once, right?
Yeah, that's and I'm not a big language guy. I mean, you would think as a writer I'm good at languages, but I'm terrible at them. I went to junior year abroad in Prague in the Czech Republic, and Czech is, related to Russian. You'd think I'd learn something. I could, beyond ordering a beer and French fries, I couldn't do anything. So this is not my strength.
But you were always a very smart boy. In fact, you don't tell these stories to boast or anything, but there's a lovely story about you educating a guide about Michelangelo.
Yes, there was the allegory of day and night, and the poor guide had gotten them. This was in Florence, and I think it was in Florence, right? Yeah, and he got them confused, and I stood up and said, excuse me, Mr. Guide, in my little nerdish Russian voice. I believe you have them mixed up or something like that. And the guide said, yes, I believe the boy is right. And everyone loved me, and my mother loved me, more importantly, and I wasn't a little failure. I was Solnushka, a little son, so that was wonderful.
But you did feel a little bit like a traitor coming here, didn't you?
No, sure. You know, you're told that you have to. It's 180 degrees different. You have to, you know, you have to worship something else. I remember we had. We were poor, of course, in Rome, and we had clothes. My only toys were these two clothing pins for laundry, and one was blue, one was red. The red one represented the Tupolev airplane. The blue one was a Boeing airplane. I would race them around, you know, running around, and I always let the Tupolev plane win because I wanted the Soviet Union to win, and my father sat me down and said, look, from now on, the Boeing wins, you know, and I was heartbroken.
You've been fascinated with aviation and cosmonauts and that whole world of space, haven't
you? Sure. I want to go to outer space. I think there's a better planet waiting for me somewhere, waiting for all of us.
Planet of the Yids?
Planet of the Yids, where pork torpedoes descend, yeah.
So what has been the response of your family to your literary celebrity? We said they were proud of you, but what else?
Proud? At my wedding, the fiction editor of The New Yorker, Deborah Treisman, asked my father what he thought of my work, and he said, the first book was okay, so God bless him. And in Hebrew school, the teachers would say, during parent teachers night, they'd say, we hear that your son reads Dostoevsky in the original. And my father would say, only Chekhov.
Chekhov was a big influence on you. Yeah. Let's talk about Chekhov, because Barishnikov's coming to town, and they're going to be doing a couple of his stories at the Berklee Repertory Theater, and... For my money, and I rarely use superlatives like this, but I don't think you can find a better storyteller.
I exactly agree. You know, I mean, big fan of Alice Munro and other storytellers and George Saunders doesn't really fall into that kind of category, but he's a great storyteller. But Chekhov remains just this amazing amount of empathy. You know, he could see a teacher in a provincial village in Russia in some broken down cart, and he could chart out her entire life in 11 pages, you know. A good short story does the same thing that a novel does. It really encompasses an entire universe. It's much harder to do that in 11 pages, which is why I don't even bother with short stories. They're much too difficult for my skill set. But reading Chekhov, this is, you know, the way people read the Talmud over and over again. That's my Talmud.
Do you have any familiarity with a story by Raymond Carver, who was a kind of mentee of Chekhov's, about Chekhov's death?
No, I never read that.
I highly recommend it.
Yes, I will. I'll Google it, as they say.
And I imagine you also, weren't you influenced by Nabokov?
Very much so. I mean, you know, Speak Memory as a kind of autobiography, but this is, my book is sort of Shout Memory or Shut Up Memory, Stop Talking Memory.
Geschrei Memory.
Geschrei Memory. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, so of course very influential because, you know, he took every word very seriously. This was a master stylist. And, you know, you sort of combine Chekhov and Nabokov and you get an amazing idea because Chekhov was a great stylist as well, but really he had this kind of empathy for human beings that Nabokov understood people, but there, you know, some novels come off better as others. My favorite novel probably of his and ever is Nabokov's Pnin, which I find to be a lovely novel where he really sort of delves into the humanity of this fellow Russian emigre, Professor Pnin, who with the explosive name Pnin, who goes through these misadventures. And that one made me cry. And there was a scene about the Holocaust there that's only one chapter long, but is one of the most moving scenes written about that I've ever read.
It's also amazing to think that I believe English was his fourth or fifth language.
He grew up trilingual, so I don't feel bad for him at all. I mean, you know, he had a governess teaching him English.
But, I mean, you read Lolita and you just realize what he's doing stylistically is virtuosity. I mean, I'm dating myself, but I remember when in Southern Ohio, where you also had experience going to Oberlin, Lolita was actually taken off of the bookshelf.
Right,
so
right.
Consider yourself a lucky, fortunate writer to be in this era.
It's good for fiction when people take it off shelves and set fire to it because it means that something really matters, that people are paying attention to it. You know, there's one of my favorite Russian writers, Vladimir Sorokin, wrote a book, a novel called Blue Lard, in which Khrushchev and Stalin engage in passionate sex. But it's, you know, it's Khrushchev being on top of Stalin. And this so infuriated the Stalinists in Moscow that they built a giant toilet and burned copies and flushed down copies of Blue Lard, and which is frightening. But at the same time, think of a nation that cares enough about literature to build a giant wooden toilet.
Do you read the poets too, or just fiction writers mainly? I remember loving Voznesensky and Yevtushenko.
And even Mayakovsky has a couple of good ones.
I like his stuff too. I mean, American and British poets? Do you read poets?
Well, I love Charles Simic is one of my favorite poets, the Yugoslav born, who writes with this kind of incredible prose flair. I mean, it's just, those are little stories. His prose poems are some of my favorites, actually.
I want to mention the title of that Carver story. It's Errand, E-R-R-A-N-D.
Errand, okay.
It's actually in a later collection of his. Let's talk a little bit about two of your, transgressive activities, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I mean, you did a lot of drugs. You did a lot of alcohol.
Sure.
What did you learn from all that?
Well, you don't learn that much. What you learn is that you need to find an outlet for all the stuff that's sort of rumbling inside you like a matryoshka doll. You know, you need to open that stuff up and get some air in there. But
The psychoanalysis,
you know. And many writers say, well, psychoanalysis will destroy your work because it sort of flattens out the anger and the joy that you have within you. But not at all. I mean, I find that it's you publish things into the air. In traditional psychoanalysis, the analyst says very little. You know, you just sort of see him behind you. He's probably Facebooking and Twittering, you know, while you're but the most important part of it is the act of simply saying things out loud.
Jonathan Franzen plays your analyst in the trailer.
In the trailer, Franzen is my analyst, and he picks up my book and he says, "Little failure, little narcissist is more like it."
Good line. Talking again with Gary Steingart, and he'll be at the Jewish Community Center this evening at 7. Email from Chuck, what was the immigrant novel you both love? Well, we mentioned Call It Sleep. We both love that.
Call It Sleep. Yeah.
Anything else you want to mention?
Yeah, I teach a course at Columbia called Immigrants a Go-Go or something. And yeah, we start with Call It Sleep. We move into Nabokov's Pnin, which I also consider an immigrant novel. And then there's a whole bunch of, I mean, some of the best literature in America is immigrant literature, I think, at this point. Although some of these immigrants, writers do not even want to be considered immigrant. They want to be considered American writers, the way Philip Roth said, "I'm not a Jewish writer, I'm an American writer." But
Bello said it too.
But Changre Lee's books are amazing. Juno Diaz, Jhumpa Lahiri. I mean, it's really an all-star cast these days.
And many of them in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Let's talk about your pursuit of girls, women, ladies. At one point you say, love who you know, and that becomes a kind of anthem. But now you're a married man, and Herb Gold did a review of your book, San Franciscan, an old friend of mine, novelist of originally from Cleveland. We both emigrated and escaped from Cleveland, in fact.
Well, that's an escape much better than from the Soviet Union, I would say. Yeah.
Thank you for that. Those props, Gary. Much appreciated. But Herb said, he ended the review by saying, now he's a married man about you.
Right, right.
Has that made a difference in terms of your imagination or your writing?
Well, there's a lot more sanity attached now to the fact that I have a wife and a small kid. So that's been, it's centering, as they say, and grounding, and very lovely. You know, all my books have been about love, in a sense, the pursuit of love. All my characters have wanted very desperately to find someone to be with, you know, in a way to escape from sort of the bonds of history and parental bonds and find love with someone else. That's very tough to do, and it doesn't really work that way. You know, you will always be who you are. You will always have your history. You will always have your parents. You will always have the good and the bad of how you grew up. But this offers a second chapter, you know, a second act, if you will, and it's lovely.
Can you tell us a little bit about your wife? I know she's Korean-American, but
she's very shy. She's very publicity shy. So let me just say she's a woman. And
no career?
I probably shouldn't say. She's very, very private about things. But she's gainfully employed, I can say that, in a way that, you know, that I'm not. So
I was going to say, not like a writer.
not like a writer. A real job.
Julie writes, I had to look up many more English words in the Russian debutante's handbook than in most books. Gary's English is better than mine, and I was born here and have a good vocabulary. The same with Alexander Heyman's works.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, growing up without speaking English real good meant that I would read English literature and American literature and just sit there with a giant notepad taking down notes. And this is before you could Google things.
Did you say that on purpose, without speaking English too good?
Yeah, I'm trying to speak English real bad.
Because that could be idiomatic, too.
Right.
You're saying speaking English.
Yeah. I know speak English great, but I would sit there with a notepad and just take down every words. And then I would use them almost very pretentiously in my works. You know, he walked over the Aubusson, you know, stuff like that.
Here's Rebecca who writes, I read Super Sad True Love Story over the holiday break. I really appreciated many parts of the book, especially the jolting prospect that the creepy, obsessive attachment to all things media and for one's self-worth to be controlled by the opinions and rankings of everyone around you doesn't seem far from reality. But I did finish the book feeling unsure of how Steingart might have hoped his readers would feel about the relationship between the two main characters. I wonder if he could comment on this.
Well, it's a super sad true love story. I mean, it literally is a story that's it's about two people from very different worlds. One is addicted to reading books. He's the last person in this future world, the last person that reads books or has books, because young people think that books have a very sour odor and they don't want to be anywhere near them. And his love is a young woman, 24 years old, who's fully digitalized and digitized. She spends most of her time shopping over this thing called the Apparat, which is a kind of future iPhone. So nothing really binds them together except for the fact that they both come from dysfunctional immigrant families. And that's sort of – so the what should the reader take away from it? I think whatever she wants to take away from it. But other than it's very hard for two people to stay together.
Well, I took away a lot about that relationship. And I also took a lot away from it about the gizmo you just mentioned, which, you know, you can go to a singles bar and find out all kinds of information just by clicking. I mean, that's the future.
That is the future. There's no doubt about it. And I was one of the first people to try out the Google Glass. And The nice people at Google did something great. They don't allow face recognition technology. So if I walk into a bar, I can't rank you because, you know, I can't – your information won't appear in my glass the way it did in the Apparat and Super Sad True Love Story. So at least they put in that little privacy kind of barrier, but I'm sure somebody will knock it over
at some
point.
But you can get blood pressure, cholesterol readings. You can probably you can get how much money in the bank maybe, all those kinds of things.
Yes.
We're talking again with Gary Steingart. His new book is called Little Failure, and it was reviewed in the New York Times by Andy Borowitz, who is a very funny guy who's been on this program. And you're of a different kind of wit and different kind of sense of humor, but I think you probably could. You're talking about alternate careers or alternate realities. You probably could have been a stand-up.
I know. What was I thinking, you know, in becoming a – you know, I was growing up when being a literary writer was considered a really hot vocation, you know. And now it's just hot and, you know – parts of the Mission in Brooklyn, you know. So it's – what was I thinking?
Come on. You've become internationally – how many – you've translated in about, what, 26 languages?
28 languages.
Yeah, come on. You made it.
But some of them barely exist, you know.
Stephen writes, will Mr. Steingart do a satire on the George W. Bush years? We are waiting.
Oh, well, Absurdistan was kind of a satire in the George W. Bush years. It came into mind when I was spending some time in Azerbaijan and Baku. And I was at the Hyatt, and there were all these prostitutes running around screaming, Golly Burton, Golly Burton. In Russian, the H is often a G, and they were screaming, Halliburton, Halliburton. They were so excited that they were going to get a lot
of...
There
is no H in Russian, which is why... How could they have an H?
That's what I mean. There's a G. Yeah, it's a G bomb. And so, you know, so I thought, my God, you know, prostitutes in the Caspian Sea know about Halliburton. Time for a George W. Bush satire.
I think the listeners here want you to do more satire. Sarah writes, I wonder if Mr. Steingart has seen the FX show The Americans about race. Reagan-era Soviet spies could be a fun avenue for his satire.
Yes, yes. It's a good friend of mine who does it, Joe Weisberg. A lovely, lovely person. Very, very smart show. I really urge people to watch it.
What do you tell people when they ask you about how you assess the present-day Russia, particularly under Putin's leadership, but also you refer to it before as a crumbling empire or maybe a crumbled empire? You present it certainly in your book as being a very tragic place.
Yeah, I mean, it's look, the thing to remember about Russia, it's always been a disaster. It probably always will be. I mean, it had the worst serfdom, the worst feudalism, the worst socialism, the worst turbo capitalism now. I mean, everything. I always talk about this restaurant in Petersburg called 1913, and I asked the owner, why 1913? And she said, it was the only good year in Russian history, and I think that's about right, you know. So Putin, I don't see him as some kind of anomaly. I see more the Yeltsin democracy era as being sort of out of step with what Russia is, which is, you know, a kleptocracy, an autocracy, a lot of other ocracies that aren't good.
When you're writing fiction, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, as opposed to memoir, you're using a completely different set of skills, one might argue, and certainly channeling differently and all that. How does that stack up for you?
Well, writing a memoir is sort of you're out there without the safety net, and the safety net is humor and satire. You know, you can push things pretty far, but then you realize that the audience needs that little jolt of humor because that's what they're in for. And writing a memoir like this, the humor is there. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not a depressing memoir, I hope. But the truth of what had happened to my parents, to more importantly, to their families, is not a happy truth. And so the humor is a kind of, you know, it's the intercontinental ballistic missile that gets the payload across. The payload is tragedy, but the humor is what allows it to soar into the sky.
remember the novelist Paul Auster, another Brooklyn boy, was talking about writing a memoir with me on the air, and he was saying it's like suddenly you're going into a desk and finding things that you didn't even know were there. And, of course, you did research for this book. He did for his memoir. Yeah. But writing a novel, you're almost, he describes being in an altered state.
That's right. That's right. You almost feel like you're, you know, Rob Ford in Toronto on your first hit of crack, and you're just soaring off into the sky. Whereas with the memoir, you can be very good in terms of, you know, you can style it, obviously. How you say it is as important as what you say. But what you say, you can't alter the plot because it's your life, you know. So you know how it's going to end.
And yet memories are... How shall I put it? Not necessarily all that trustworthy. And, you know, they do fictionalize. You fictionalize.
Yeah,
you. Yeah, your memory fictionalizes.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, I mean, one reason why I tried to check as much as possible with, you know, people with whom I was smoking all that pot and to see if I could figure out if, you know, 3% of what we remember is the truth. And that's the parts that I hopefully used. But there are no guarantees. You know, you have to trust your memory and hope that you get as much of it right as possible.
Do you remember how good the pot was? I mean, was it Acapulco gold? They used to use that term. Remember in Southern Ohio?
It was terrible pot because it was northeastern Ohio, you know.
Yeah.
And I was just in Seattle where it's legal now. And good Lord, these people are stoned out of their minds, you know.
Really? You saw a lot of that in Seattle?
Oh, good Lord, yeah. I mean, I saw two people very high get into a beard fight. They just fought with their gigantic rabbinical-sized beards and... I thought, that's Seattle for you.
Speaking of rabbinical and the exclamation, good Lord, are you still a believer? Are you a believer?
I don't, no.
You have faith?
I'm an agnostic like everyone else. I just, hopefully if there was a God, you know, a Yahweh type dude hanging around, that would be wonderful. But I don't see the empirical proof yet.
Well, if there is, he certainly smiled on you. He gave you a lot of gifts.
And that's very true.
It's been a delight to have you back here. Good luck with the new book.
Thank you so much.
Gary Steingart's new book, again, a memoir called Little Failure. He'll be at the Jewish Community Center this evening at 7 p.m. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. We remind you that you can always continue conversation by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. And email us if you have something to suggest in the way of programming or response to programming you've heard. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. We want to bid Keelan Cronin all kinds of good things. She leaves us today as an intern. We will miss her. Thank you for being a part of the program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.